You're listening to the Common Sense Financial Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Scribonia. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get into today's topic. Hello, I'm Brian Scribonia, and you're listening to the Common Sense Financial Podcast. I think that we would all agree that 2020 has been a year for the history books. COVID-19 has shifted the way we think, how we spend our time, how we conduct business, our entertainment, virtual learning. Just when you stop and think about it, everything just seems to be different. Of course, like all things, we eventually adapt to a new normal, but it does take some time and it takes learning new ways of doing things. And being open to these things is fundamentally important, in my opinion, to the quality of life we live and our success that we experience. In the midst of all these quarantines, I hear people wishing for things to go back to how they were, and they just really want everything to pass. They're resisting all that has changed in their life while finding themselves depressed and oftentimes disappointed with everything. This same attitude applies to how money is managed and invested. Traditional public markets have been historically viewed as normal when it comes to investing, but over the last decade, we've seen a shift in this attitude towards finding an alternative to the stock market. Though we have been seeing a shift in investor behavior and attitudes about markets for quite some time, COVID has brought about a sense of urgency to the conversation for finding that alternative to traditional markets. And it's not difficult to understand why. The abrupt volatility that investors have experienced lately has them going from peak to valley in a matter of days. And any rational investor at one point or another has questioned if there's a better way. Now, to be clear, there is risk in any type of investment. There's no unicorn that can deliver all things good. But I do believe that a new normal is taking shape that offers investors an updated paradigm of what diversification really looks like. Now, whether you realize that this was happening or not, this path is already being paved for by forward-thinking investors and money managers who recognized this shift several years ago and are now operating under that new normal. I believe what we are discussing here is the answer to what many investors are asking for, and it's why I decided to spend time today sharing this information with you. Today, I have on with us portfolio manager Daniel Wildermuth to discuss the growing interest in private markets and how they differ from public markets. Daniel is a 25-year veteran managing portfolios in both traditional and alternative markets and has been a pioneer in what we're going to be discussing today. He's authored two books, is a sought-after speaker at industry conferences, and is often quoted as an expert in the fields of alternative investments, the stock market, and just the economy in general. He's garnered media coverage from Barron's, Investment News, Forbes Magazine, Family Office Magazine, CNBC, Bravo TV, Dow Jones Newswire, and other financial market news outlets. He earned an MBA in finance from Anderson School at UCLA, an undergraduate degree in engineering from Stanford University. He's the founder and CEO of multiple financial services firms, including Wildermuth Advisory, Wildermuth Securities, Wildermuth Asset Management, Kalos Capital, and Kalos Management. Now, I was first introduced to Daniel and his wife, Carol, in Atlanta when a group of advisors and I were traveling and interviewing different firms that specialized in alternative investments. The firm we were with at the time was moving in the opposite direction of where we were trying to go, and we just found Kalos had exactly what we were looking for at the time. It's been a good relationship, and when I thought about where we are here in 2020, I thought Daniel would be a great person to bring on and talk about the state of affairs. Hey, welcome, Daniel, to the Common Sense Financial Podcast. Glad you're here, and looking forward to our conversation today.
Oh, it's very much a pleasure to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. So just tell us a little bit about, you know, where you started in the world of finance and kind of the path you're headed right now, just to give our audience a little bit of a background for us.
Sure. Certainly very quickly, I graduated as an engineer out of Stanford, but the summer before I graduated, I took an engineering job and realized I didn't want to do that. So I got married, moved to New York City. Started on Wall Street, did that for a few years before going back to graduate school, and then spent a few years overseas, first in Eastern Europe. The wall had just come down, and there was lots of interesting opportunities over there, and then landed in finance in Hong Kong. Spent a few years there, traveling around throughout the East in one form or another, doing a lot of consulting to banks and different organizations, and then came back and started different companies. I guess the first of what proved to be more than we anticipated. Financial services firms. I started those with my wife. And so we've been at this point I guess a married couple for 33 years and been working together for 22. It's been a little bit a while. And over the course of the years, I've started various financial firms, all focused around effectively managing assets in one form or another and working to help advisors better serve their clients.
That's awesome. So you sound like you got a pretty wide, not just in as far as what you know, but just where you've been, seeing the rest of the world. You know, one of the things that I definitely want to jump right into head first is just the likelihood of the markets as they are, you know, have been, and our economy and how things are functioning, and just how likely that is to continue to operate in the future as it has in the past. And like I said in the opening, you know, we get settled into what we believe to be a normal, and we have a difficult time visualizing something to be different until, of course, you know, that happens. But with artificially low interest rate environment that we're in, you know, government debt and inflation, looming tax hikes that we know are likely around the corner, and just baby boomers retiring, the political division, you know, I just personally have a belief that things aren't necessarily going to look and feel the same into the future as they are in the past. So what are your thoughts on that, and what have investors done in the, what do you think that investors are going to be doing going forward as opposed to where they have been in the past?
Yeah, well, certainly a lot of a lot of different topics, or a lot of different potential topics in that question. Yeah, it's been the you know, the likelihood of things being the same, I think, over the next decade plus as they've been over the past decade, are pretty low, just because there's so many different just circumstances and changes in one form or another that we're facing. Of course, a decade ago, we were only a couple of years out of the financial crash. And at that point, very low valuations and very low expectations in many ways for the economy, and a relatively low growth rate. But at the time, we were just really starting to see some growth come back. But companies were cheap. I remember standing up in front of a group of advisors, and this was the summer of 2009, and telling advisors, you know, kind of doesn't matter what you do, just get your clients to assume risk somewhere because everything's on sale. Mm-hmm. And just everything was cheap. Didn't matter if it was public markets, private markets, everything was cheap because there was a lot of concern, a lot of panic. And I said, I don't know where we're going to be at this year in 2 years, but in 5 years, if you just get your clients to take risk, you're going to look really smart because everything's on sale. Yeah. Today, it's kind of the opposite set of circumstances where almost everything's really expensive. We've come out of a decade, you know, in the last couple of years have been incredibly calm in the market, have been very, very predictable, you know, and we had one entire year where the market didn't move more than 1% the entire year. That's mm-hmm. never happened before. There's a whole bunch of other measures where we just didn't see the market move forward that steadily. And, you know, it was great. There was different circumstances for it. We had solid growth, obviously record low unemployment. There was a lot of great, just very, very strong tailwinds that brought us to that level. And then, of course, COVID happened. So mm-hmm. now we've got all these bizarre sets of uncertainties and unknown data and change. And you now have a situation where we've also got the tech behemoths are driving so much of what's happened with the market. I mean, just five stocks, Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft. Just those five stocks alone are 23%, almost a quarter of the entire S&P 500, because it's a capitalization weighted index. Mm-hmm. And so what happens with those companies drives so much of what's happening with the market, but the market is not the economy. And even during, you know, kind of what's happening with that, you know, Apple is a great example. Over the last year and a half or so, Apple's stock has just skyrocketed. And, you know, the arguments that these are great companies and they're potentially benefiting from COVID, well, that sounds kind of good on the surface. It's kind of, you know, investors are now willing to pay twice as much for a given dollar of earnings or for a given dollar of revenue, it doesn't matter which measure you take, as they were a year and a half ago. And Apple's a great company, nothing against Apple, but is it that much better than it was a year ago? And mm-hmm. the world hasn't changed that much for Apple. I mean, it's something where, you know, people are still using iPhones and iPads, et cetera, but the world has not dramatically shifted for Apple. So why is the company now worth basically more than twice what it was a year and a half ago? And that's what's driving a lot of valuations. And that's something that just really can't continue indefinitely. Mm-hmm. So with things being so expensive, the likelihood that particularly the stock market repeats over the next decade what it did this last decade, which was really fantastic if you were invested in equities, the likelihood of that repeating just seems extraordinarily low. It just, and a lot of it, you know, valuations, they tend to be a very poor short-term predictor. So, you know, not necessarily very good for the next 12 to 18 months. But you look at 5 and 10 years down the road, and valuations are an extremely accurate predictor of how well markets are going to do. And basically, when things are cheap, it's a great time to go in. When things are expensive, just tends to create a lot of headwinds.
So with everything that's happening in the markets, to your point, like with an Apple, you know, the valuations, the stock price and everything, and the way people are buying things and the way people are behaving is not necessarily representative of, like, to your point, the economy and what's actually happening behind the curtain.
Yeah. Well, you take even a more kind of egregious example of that. Tesla's shares are up over 400% this year. Mm-hmm. The price to earnings ratio of Tesla is over 1100. Mm. So if Tesla simply dropped down to Apple's already high inflated price to earnings ratio, Tesla would drop by 97%. Mm. And so and Tesla, it's not basing it all on fundamentals. It's basing on momentum. Individual investors are now twice as active, at least on a percentage of shares traded, as they were a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, they tend to be heavily involved in a lot of the momentum stocks, a lot of the big tech names that people are familiar with. And what tends to happen is those, and again, no guarantee that this happens in the near term, and no guarantees that it's a bubble that pops. But historically, when that happens, it tends to mean that it is a bubble and things tend to kind of end badly. You don't know when that'll happen and how that'll happen, mm-hmm. But that just tends to have been what history has given us in the past.
So looking at the fact that we have, you know, this bubble that's been created, as you put it, and knowing kind of what we pointed out with interest rates and, you know, potential tax hikes and just all these different things that are happening, what do you find more sophisticated or quote unquote most successful investors are doing and how they're investing going forward? How are they thinking differently?
Yeah, I mean, possibly one of the, I guess, best examples that people can pretty easily understand is endowments. Mm-hmm. They tend to have been one of the leaders in adopting more sophisticated approaches to investment strategy historically. And they have been kind of steadily exiting public markets, maybe not completely, although some are almost completely out of public markets. But they're moving more and more into private markets and looking at opportunities that tend to be, from their perspective, basically less expensive to get into, mm-hmm. and often more predictable as well. So they tend to be rooted more in fundamentals. The market can be great. If the market's really cheap, it can be a fabulous place to put a lot of dollars in because you're buying things on sale. And I mentioned a decade ago, that was the case. You wanted to be in the market because everything was so inexpensive, because the market just tends to over panic or get overly enthusiastic. And many would argue today that the market is potentially overly enthusiastic or just doesn't represent as much opportunity. And the more sophisticated investors, as they're recognizing that, they're really looking more towards effectively investments that are not public securities, whether that's stocks or bonds. They tend to be, you know, at least moving away from that. In fact, if you look at a typical large endowment, meaning somebody over an endowment over $1 billion, they generally have around 60% of their investments that are outside of public markets. And the bigger they get, that number actually even gets larger. Mm-hmm. So you look at somebody like Yale, who is really seen as the forefather, the predecessor, the kind of the pioneer in this space. They only have, at this point, 2.25% of their total portfolio in U.S. stocks. They have a little bit more in developed market stocks, but a very large percentage of their total portfolio is invested into private markets. And that's true, like I said, of a lot of particularly the larger, more sophisticated endowments.
Mm-hmm. So you're just seeing you personally are seeing a shift in mindset away from traditional markets into more private markets.
Yeah, certainly. And part of it too is the private market opportunities have expanded dramatically. If you were trying to invest in private markets, you know, 30 years ago, there just wasn't the opportunities available that there are today. The other thing is that ironically, over the last, 35, 45 years, the number of public companies has actually dropped substantially in the United States. There's only about half of the number of traded companies available to invest in that there were, several decades ago, which is a bit of a surprise because the economy obviously has gotten significantly larger, and yet there's far fewer public companies. And, you know, and again, it's more of an extreme example, but I mentioned, you know, five companies are now representative of a quarter of the S&P 500. And we're seeing that, though, to some degree across the whole universe of equities where you have a more and more of a concentration of what's happening in smaller and smaller positions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can represent both opportunity and potential risk. And today's environment where those companies are trading at very high multiples, I think many would argue it's more risk, but also means just with more concentration, you're likely to have potentially more volatility or be susceptible to a smaller set of variables. And we've certainly seen that happen here over the last several months as COVID has changed the world in many ways.
Yeah, you said an interesting thing there just about diversification, because I think a lot of times people will look at the markets, the public markets, and say, hey, if I have some large cap stocks and mid cap and small cap and a little bit of international and maybe even mix in some bonds in there, that I have the standardized diversified portfolio, right? But what we're seeing is that all that stuff's kind of floating through the market up and down in tandem. And so the diversification feel is not there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you tend to have, you know, if you go mid cap versus small cap, as you mentioned, that's kind of been the, I know some are familiar with something referred to as the Morningstar style boxes, and you have kind of value versus growth and then small versus large, and you try to pick in those different squares, but the correlation historically has been really high between those boxes. So, you know, if you've got 90% of the same activity across those boxes, it doesn't tend to buy you as much diversification. Ironically, there's actually been less correlation over the last, certainly the last decade and even the last year than what has historically been the case. The correlation is still pretty high, but it's gone down a little bit. And part of it, again, is because if you've held those big tech stocks, your performance has been better than if you didn't. And so a lot of performance has been driven by, did you have exposure to just a very small number of companies? So that's a little bit different than historical norm. There's still, like I said, very high correlation, but it's actually changed a little bit just because the differences between sectors has been higher than what has historically been the case. And a lot of that's just sort of the uncertainty and to some degree panic that's been associated with COVID, where people are guessing at what might be happening 12 to 18 months down the road because you know, nobody really knows. But there's a lot of projections that are going on out there in terms of how things are going to recover. Is tech really going to take over the world? You've got, if you had a lot of money in Norwegian Cruise Lines or some of the other kind of entertainment stocks, they just got absolutely slaughtered over these last several months. More divergence than we typically seeing, but still across public markets, a lot of correlation.
So when it comes to diversification in your mind, it's less about, because I think about a typical 401k portfolio, you know, you have a client that comes in, they have the typical very narrow list of opportunities they have inside of a 401k, let's say, and it's typically like what we just said, it's the small, medium, large, international. Typically, there's really not much outside of that, maybe a money market, a bond fund, and all these target date funds. But you're saying that's less important going forward because of just correlation issues, that we really need to find those asset classes, sectors to really get diversified. And so even that one-off 401k that has real estate, maybe some of these people need to be thinking about that as a sleeve, as opposed to just looking at U.S. companies. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, certainly. That's what you see a lot of the institutions doing. They're trying to, the whole idea of diversification is you want to keep your performance relatively high, and they're often targeting what is seen more as private markets in one form or another, because they believe the performance is going to be strong, but they don't believe it's going to be driven by the same factors that are driving public markets. And as well, they don't believe that effectively some of, I think, the hyper, possibly overly optimistic expectations that may be driving the market multiples right now, it just doesn't tend to be as much of a factor within those areas because of the general level of sophistication of investors. It's not that institutions can't make mistakes or can't get carried away overly enthusiastic either. But they tend to be much less likely to do so, and they tend to at least do it based on a lot of data and trends. Again, it doesn't mean they're going to be right, but you know, you don't see a lot of institutions outside of hedge funds that are kind of had trading strategies that are really banking on Tesla continuing to go get higher and higher and higher. That's a trading play. It's not really a fundamentally driven investment.
Yeah, one of the things that I mentioned in the opening was just what people consider normal, and why I thought this podcast was so important, this topic, is because I think where people are a little bit trapped mentally is just that traditional mindset of everything we just talked about, right? Is a diversified portfolio is small, medium, large, U.S. companies, a little bit of international and bonds. And my fear is if that people, just typical investors, don't start realizing that there's a lot of things happening outside of that box that they're missing out on, that they're going to see more and more volatility going forward. You know, my interest in private markets, AKA, you know, alternatives, really surfaced after the housing bubble. You know, it just pointed me in a direction that says, hey, we got to find something that's different, because what preceded that, of course, what a lot of people don't talk about, because everything's focused on what happened during the housing bubble. But, you know, we had the tech bubble, right? Yeah. And then we had 9/11. Yeah. And we just, you know, 2000, everybody knows that that was a really devastating decade. But the volatility that we've seen, you know, ever since that point has just been off the charts. And so trying to find, you know, that alternative, that outside influence that we can add to the portfolio to try to narrow those peaks and valleys has been a real desire of mine. And that's when I started researching, you know, these alternative markets in Yale, and then, you know, got turned on to what you were doing and whatnot, which led me here. So I guess just from a listener standpoint, because you and I understand, you know, what this really means, but maybe when we talk about an endowment portfolio, can you provide a little bit more specific detail on what we're really talking about there?
Yeah, you know, unlike a traditional model that a lot of people implement, you know, it's often referred to, as a 60-40 model, which means 60% stock, 40% bonds. Very basic, been around for a long time. You know, it tends to have generated decent returns historically, and you have the bonds in there to offset the stock, so that hopefully reduces your volatility, your ups and downs during inevitable market moves. The challenge with that, and we're seeing how many reports come out in this in one form or another, is that model looks challenged going forward, because it simply depends on, you know, 40% in bonds and the returns, the interest rates, you're probably not going to get much return out of that. And then, of course, with your 60% in stocks, if your valuations are very high and that doesn't do as well for the next decade, it's challenging. So what endowments do is the typical endowment model basically says we're going to add a lot more high performance asset classes with high performance expectations. So it tends to be private equity, real estate. They often use absolute return investments, which typically means hedge funds. They've got other types of investments as well, which is often brilliantly branded as other. But forms of investments that have relatively high performance expectations. Then the idea is that if they add that to the portfolio and they don't have all the performance-oriented assets that are correlated, if the market goes down, their other investments are not going to be nearly as affected by whatever is driving the market either up or down. Mm-hmm. And so that independent performance is going to be relatively independent. If they can do that, they can reduce both the amount allocated to individual stocks, but as importantly, they can also reduce the amount allocated to fixed income, which means that they can still have basically a much higher performing portfolio, or at least the expectation of one, as they obviously as the design goes. But they don't have all the volatility associated with having just equities. Because, of course, if you just want high performance over long term, one could argue, well, just put everything in stocks. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't want to do that for obvious reasons, and also your timing can really impact what your total return performance is. If, you know, putting 100% of your assets today in stocks, I would suggest probably is not particularly wise. Mm-hmm. But with the endowment, the idea is that, okay, we don't have to have so much exposure dependence on stocks, and we can really reduce our exposure to fixed income, which particularly today has very, very poor performance expectations. Mm-hmm. And the result of that is a portfolio from a design standpoint with relatively high expectations for performance, but without all the volatility that's generally associated with having a large allocation to equities.
Mm-hmm. So that, I guess, based on what you just said and everything that we're talking about here, and I don't remember exactly when this started, maybe you can give us a glimpse into that, but this led you to actually creating your own fund because you saw an opportunity there in this space, because not a lot of people are talking about it, right? But seeing the trajectory of where markets are going, seeing the trajectory of where investors are ultimately going to end up, you actually opened up an endowment-centered fund called the Wildermuth Endowment Fund. Maybe just tell us a little bit about that. What led you to that? How long that's been around, and what your focus is inside of that fund?
Yeah, one of the challenges, for some individuals can be that there's a lot of opportunities out there, but it can be somewhat difficult to access them. Mm-hmm. And of course, it can also be both a little bit more work, or it can be complicated. So one of the things we wanted to do was create a fund that would enable people to invest in very, very similar style, and in some cases, even the exact same investments that endowments are investing into, but do that as an individual investor. And obviously, most investors don't have $1 billion to invest effectively to create a team and bring people in like a typical endowment does. So we've created a structure and a format that allows investors to basically put their investments into the same types of investments that endowments are using. So mm-hmm. It's, again, a significant amount into private equity, into various real estate, direct real estate holdings, hedge funds, and then having a certain amount of liquidity so that we can provide liquidity for people as needed, at least on a quarterly basis. But that really, it's not a lot more complicated than that, but it was really trying to make the same style available to individuals that the endowments are following. And like I say, in some cases, it's actually even the exact same investments. You're sitting alongside the endowments in the same types of things. But you know, for better or worse, one of the other things that's different about endowments is there is no single endowment strategy. So, you know, somebody may have 20% in real estate, somebody else may have 10. It's more of a philosophy that says we're going to diversify substantially into private markets. And part of what makes that a little more difficult is that if you have a 60-40 stock bond portfolio, it's really easy. If your stocks go up, you can sell off some of your stocks and readjust into bonds. Mm-hmm. Within private equity, if your private equity goes up, you may not have the opportunity to get out really quickly. And so it often takes a little bit longer to rebalance a portfolio. Mm-hmm. So inevitably, the differences tend to grow a little bit across those endowments. But similar to what they're doing, that's what we're trying to do in terms of giving them that exposure and something that is professionally managed and has high quality assets in the private market sector.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you just said there was an important point. But, you know, obviously all investments are long-term. All investments have risk. But at the end of the day, we're just trying to level out that peak and valley experience, right? Because, we won't get into the math, but, you know, an 8% average versus an 8% real return can be a very different experience along the way, right? And it can result in higher numbers, higher amounts of money in your pocket, even if the same numbers exist, a real return versus an average, if those peaks and valleys are compressed. And so that's where I see private markets come into play, not to mention, you know, the diversification of style, you know, capital appreciation versus income. That is another opportunity of diversification that we talk a lot about, just to try to diversify. But you said a key point, and I think what is good about your fund is that, you know, with a lot of alternative investments or private market investments, the threshold to get into them can be pretty steep sometimes for people. And even at that institutional level, it could be very significant where most people can't even be exposed to that type of stuff. So using something like your fund can be an entry point for people to be able to get into something that they would never, ever be able to get into somewhere else.
Yeah, well, we see that you mentioned the hurdles for investment. We're in, you know, we obviously have a significant slug in private equity. Mm-hmm. And for some of those funds, you know, a typical investor, you don't want to even, if you're a typical investor, to go into a single private equity fund, because then you have exposure only to a single, they're referred to as vintage years. Mm-hmm. So everything you depend on private equity depends on that particular year. And you know, this year is a good example. If you happen to be going in to a private equity fund that's raising capital now, that's probably a good thing because they've got a lot of dry powder right mm-hmm. at a time when there's a lot of disruption in the market. But if you went into one that was, you know, a few years ago or possibly was in the wrong place at the wrong time, you don't get the diversification of having different types of investments. And the other challenge is that for a lot of those, the minimum investment is $5, $10, or $20 million. And that's obviously difficult for somebody to get wide diversification across multiple mm-hmm. funds if each one requires a $20 million minimum investment. Right. It's mm-hmm. just not practical. So for us, we're able to bypass a lot of that for people and give them access to something they just couldn't get on their own.
You know, another thing too, just as we look at what we're talking about here and the kind of the writing on the wall as we go forward with everything that's going on. It just seems, you know, and I think some people would phrase it this way, that world just seems a little bit crazy right now. You know, we have COVID fears, we have civil unrest, we have wildfires, we have hurricanes. I mean, not to mention everything else we've just talked about. I mean, the world seems like it's on fire. Yeah. And so when you think about all that stuff and get out of your day-to-day routines and just step back and look and see what's happening, where do you see, you know, things going forward? I mean, here we are at the end of September recording a podcast. We got an election around the corner. You know, of course, things vary depending on who gets elected. But what are some of your, because I know you follow economics very closely, right? Managing in a fund. Where do you see things going into the future?
Well, you know, one of the great things about the United States and a capitalist economy, and we still are one, even though we've got some people who are somehow trying to change that, opportunities are still there. So, you know, we still remain optimistic about different possibilities. You know, for instance, within their own portfolio, we love a lot of the holdings we have and are very optimistic about opportunities that we continue to see. Technology is changing the world. It is bringing new opportunities. I mean, whether it's genetic sequencing or various things that we potentially may be developing that impact health positively. You know, they're talking about trying to have a vaccine come out already this year. I mean, previously that had never been done, I think, in less than like a 7-year time period. And we're talking about doing it in 6 to 8 months. Now, it hasn't been done yet, so it may or may not be successful. But still, the amount we're collapsing health developments down, and you know, the fact that we're having this conversation the way we're having it, you know, which just a short number of years ago wouldn't have been possible. Mm-hmm. So developments are out there. So there's lots of positives. The flip side is that there's also certainly some headwinds out there. The Office of Budgeting came out with their projection for GDP growth. And they've lowered it 25 basis points from just a year ago, based on all the debt that's come out and some of the ongoing challenges that have come up because of COVID. And by a quarter point, that's a quarter point over a 30-year time period. So that's a quarter point expected GDP growth from the year 2020 to year 2050. Mm. So, you know, against this, there are definitely going to be some headwinds. And you see that now. There's some people who are relatively unaffected by COVID. Now, their lifestyle may be, but their income is relatively unaffected. Mm-hmm. You've got some people who are obviously benefiting, and then you have a large number of people who are really adversely impacted by this. If you're, you know, hospitality, kind of in any way, shape, or form, you've obviously seen potentially some real challenges for you. You know, I look at it from an investor standpoint, and, you know, where things were cheap a decade ago, I mentioned this already, they're expensive now. And it's something that I think it's more imperative for the typical investor to go out and search for different opportunities. It was kind of easy a decade ago. You could kind of invest in anything and it was probably going to go up. Mm-hmm. Today, that's just tougher. A lot more headwinds in a lot more places. But again, it's not that there's not opportunities, as I think there absolutely are. There may be in different places, though, and they may be in different packages, and they may be accessed in a different way than what has been in the past. But you know, you started out the podcast on this saying that things have changed, and they have. And that's before we get a different, you know, whether we get, it's before presidential elections are determined. So you know, things are different. So I think it requires people to basically plan and act somewhat differently.
One of the things I get asked a lot about, you know, in an election year is, you know, what happens if this president gets elected? What happens if this president gets elected? And I don't try to forecast any of that stuff. But one thing that I do often say is that, you know, tax hikes and increased regulations typically don't bode well for the markets. What would be some comments you would make on, you know, what potential changes we can see if those types of things were to happen, if taxes were to go up, if regulation were to go up, and anything else you think of that may be warranted there, how would that impact markets, at least in the short term?
Yeah, you know, you kind of already said it in the sense that, you know, higher taxes and higher regulation, that's just never seen as market friendly. Mm-hmm. Business doesn't do as well. You just don't see the same profits. Things are slower. You know, to some degree, Europe has gone that route in different areas, which is part of the reason that, you know, over, I don't know, about a 30, 40 year time period, our income has doubled relative to France's. Wonderful country, but our GDP per capita has grown much faster than theirs. And that's been true for all of developed Europe. And a lot of that is because they simply do have significantly higher taxes and much, much greater regulation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are definitely headwinds. And if you, you know, if the market perceives that those are going to introduce headwinds, the market tends to be very anticipatory in terms of how it trades. So just a couple of days, I've been reading about the amount of trades that are being put in place that are betting on a lot of volatility associated with the elections. But it's not just the elections. It's the assumption that the elections are going to be contested for several weeks after the elections. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with the policies being put forth by the two different candidates are different. One would obviously be more of the same, for better or worse, whatever that means. Another, you know, has been very, you know, most would categorize it as an anti-growth platform. But it's also hard to know how much of that is posturing and how much of that is really policy that is really intended to be put in place. But if they do, you know, if that is pursued and you really end up with higher taxes going into place, markets don't like that. Part of the reason we had the big market run up was because of the decrease in corporate taxes. Flip side, if you see those corporate taxes go up, putting us back, and we are the highest corporate taxes in the developed world prior to those. So it's something, it's not like we've suddenly become this incredibly low tax country. We're simply the highest in the world already. So this was bringing us down into much more competitive circumstances. And if we kind of put that back up into a higher category, it's hard to imagine kind of any scenario that ends up being good for financial markets.
There's definitely a lot to talk about here. And, you know, I think we could probably wrap it up right there. But I guess for the fund itself, for your fund, if somebody wanted to get any information on that, where could they go to get that information?
There's wildermuthfund.com or somebody just do a search on Wildermuth Endowment Fund and it comes up as well. So whether you remember the URL or not. And we work, as I believe you know, we work through financial advisors. So it's something that most people end up talking to a financial advisor and getting more information on that in terms of is really appropriate for them with their strategy and with their goals. Like I said, there's plenty of information if somebody just does a search on the name Wildermuth Endowment Fund or Wildermuth Fund out there on the internet.
And of course, all of our listeners or our clients are welcome to just give us a shout and we can provide any information on that as well. So perfect. Thanks, Daniel. I appreciate your time today joining us and just providing your insight into what I feel like is one of the most important topics of today is just how things are going to be operating into the future. So I do appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure. Enjoyed talking with you, Brian.
Okay, everybody, that concludes today's podcast. I'm Brian Scribonia. Thanks for listening to the Common Sense Financial Podcast.
Well, thank you for listening to the Forbes Top 10 Rated Common Sense Financial Podcast. Before you go, I want to encourage you to jump over to briansgribonia.com to access the full archive of blogs and podcasts. And if you want to be the first in line to get new content, you can sign up for free on the Brian Scribonia website as well. If you're not following Brian on all the social channels, we'd love to have you join in on the conversation. Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, he's there. Lastly, if you've enjoyed listening to today's podcast or if you have found value in any of our content, help spread the word by sharing our videos, podcasts, and posts wherever you get them. We greatly appreciate it and are glad that you took the time to join us today. This material is educational in nature and should not be deemed as a solicitation of any specific product or service. All investments involve risk and a potential loss of principal. Kalos Capital nor Kalos Management offer tax or legal advice. Please consult with a tax advisor or attorney for advice regarding the impact on your portfolio. Securities offered through Kalos Capital Incorporated, member of FINRA, SIPC, MSRB, and investment advisory services offered through Kalos Management Incorporated, an SEC registered investment advisor, both located at 11525 Parkwood Circle, Alpharetta, Georgia 30005. Kalos Capital Incorporated and Kalos Management Incorporated do not provide tax or legal advice. Scribonia Financial Group, LLC and Scribonia Insurance Services, LLC are not an affiliate or subsidiary of Kalos Capital Incorporated or Kalos Management Incorporated. The opinions in the preceding commentary are as of the date of publication and are subject to change. Information has been obtained from a third-party source we consider reliable, but we do not guarantee the facts cited are accurate or complete. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast or investment advice regarding a particular investment or the markets in general, nor is it intended to predict or depict performance of any investment. We may execute transactions and securities that may not be consistent with the report's conclusions. Investors should consult with their financial advisor on the strategy best for them. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. There are material differences between the terms under which endowments and individuals can invest in alternative investments. These differences include, but are not limited to, commissions and fees, conflicts of interest, access to investment opportunities, size, investment time horizons, and the ability to tolerate illiquidity. There is no stated or exact definition of the endowment model. Portfolio design, specific investments, and ultimately performance vary considerably among endowments and investors. Kalos does not claim that any investor will achieve the same result as any endowment, institution, or other investor. Kalos's investment advisor representatives have a conflict of interest when they recommend securities where they earn a commission as registered representatives of Kalos Capital. We address this conflict by disclosing the fees and commissions related to the investments recommended to our clients. Also, Kalos representatives do not earn both advisory fees and brokerage commissions on the same asset. Alternative investments represent speculative investments and involve a high degree of risk. An investor could lose all or a substantial portion of his or her investment. Investors must have the financial ability, sophistication, experience, and willingness to bear the risks of an investment in an alternative investment. Any investment in alternative investment funds should be discretionary capital set aside strictly for speculative purposes. Alternative investment offering documents are not reviewed or approved by federal or state regulators. Some alternative investments may have little or no operating history or performance and may use hypothetical or pro forma performance, which may not reflect actual trading done by the manager or advisor and should be reviewed carefully. Investors should not place undue reliance on hypothetical or pro forma performance. The opinions in this publication are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. We suggest that you consult your accountant, tax, or legal advisor with regard to your individual situation.